I handed our master the glass. It was always that way.
Hey China, baby, you played too rough. You slapped 34 on him, now that ain't love. I gave you till Tuesday to say you're sorry, but guess what, sweetie, that ship sailed early. Don't cry on the trading floor, it's just diplomacy but hardcore. We talked to some countries, not all. Guess which empire won't get a call. We're in a terror fever, turn it up some more. 50 on 34, now we're out on normal floor. Don't need no trade talks, we just do the math. Taking my sports, baby, feel my wrath. We got that terror fever, shaking every port. Seeking markets like it's a contact sport. Raise it high, spin that tax roulette. If you retaliate, I'll double the bet. Next, oh, don't look shocked. 10% for friendship, consider it doc. We're spreading love like a steel toe boot. Global harmony in a tailored suit. Every deficit's a dagger to my pride, so I'll fix it with some duties on the side. Who needs allies when you've got the vibe? Just me, my posts, and my 40 tribe. Yeah, it's terror fever, truth posted loud. Dancing through the trade war, feeling proud. Markets crash, that's just the sound of greatness echoing around. And on a 4%, man, that's how we roll. Every import tax like rock and roll. So in the world tonight.
This isn't a tantrum. It's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports through your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm working harder.
We've got tariff fever as I'm with the moon. Trade toss canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. Want a 4%? Baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit and tax the rhyme. Hit that beat and tax the rhyme.
This isn't a tantrum. It's strategic performance art. We're liberating your exports from your control. And hey, if your economy collapses, that just means I'm winning harder.
We got the terror fever rising with the moon. Trade talks canceled, no reply soon. So let's all dance to the price of bread and spin these sanctions till we're dead. 1-4%, baby, that's the deal. When feelings are facts and pain is real, we're making history one post at a time. Now hit that beat and tax the rhyme. And tax the rhyme.
My mother would prepare the soda, and I would hand him the glass. But I am confessing all this before you, brothers, as before God. You won't tell anyone. No one will ever ask us, said Taka. So that means you ran away from prison, does it? Yes, I ran away, good friend. 14 of us escaped. God be with them. They ran away and took me along, too. Now judge for yourself, lad, and tell me honestly whether I have any reason for telling my name. I should be condemned to penal servitude again. What sort of a convict am I? I'm delicate and sickly. I like cleanliness in my food and in the places where I sleep. When I pray to God, I like to have a little shrine lamp or a candle burning, and I don't like to have noises going on round me when I'm praying. When I prostrate myself, I don't like to have the floor all filthy and spat over. I prostrate myself 40 times, morning and night, for my mother's salvation. The tramp takes off his cap and crosses himself. But let them send me to Eastern Siberia if they want to, he cries. I'm not afraid of that. What, is that better? It is an entirely different affair. At hard labor, you are no better off than a crab in a basket. You are crowded and pushed and hustled. There's not a quiet corner to take breath. It's a hell on earth. The mother of God forbid it. A ruffian you are. And a ruffian's treatment you receive, worse than any dog's. You get nothing to eat. There's nowhere to sleep, and nowhere to say your prayers. In exile, it's different. You first enroll yourself in the company, as everyone else does. The government is compelled by law to give you your share of land. Yes, indeed. Land, they say, is cheap there, as cheap as snow. You can take all you want. They would give me land for farming, lad, and land for a garden, and land for a house. Then I would plow and sow, as other men do, raise cattle and bees and sheep and dogs. I'd get myself a Siberian cat to keep the rats and mice from eating my property. I'd build me a house, brothers, and buy icons. And God willing, I'd marry and have children.
All of that, just for a sec, what started as this kind of existential mystery has taken on a lot of baggage and flesh. He says he's the illegitimate child of a rich man by his mistress. He helped his mother kill the old man. He's a convict. He doesn't say his name. This is a homeless man on the streets of New York, and he's been pulled over. But if he gives his name, he goes back to penal servitude. Something's up here, but I just wonder, what layers of this sort of waiting for Godot mystery can we unpeel?
I've never heard Siberia described in such a pot. I'm like, this sounds good.
Right.
Cat, house, bees.
Maybe children, maybe a great estate.
This whole time.
Eastern Siberia.
Okay.
So who is he? Who is Godot here?
Well, that's like part of it. I think there's this whole theme of dehumanization. You know, he felt like a crab in this labor camp, and now he's lost his name, which is, you know, what makes you yourself. So that theme is running through.
But he has his story.
Yeah.
Again, the dog. Even a dog can remember his name. Mm-hmm. Any notion where we're going? Is it still a kind of Godot picture or not?
Seems like it got real all of a sudden. Like, there was a crime. There was imprisonment.
Right.
He has a history.
Maybe he's a noble man. Maybe he's a poor peasant. There's a lot of class thing.
And again, we have the mother drilling her son, like, my boy is going to have a higher station in life than I did.
Yeah. Okay. Nyazi, over to you.
The tramp is murmuring to himself now and has ceased looking at his listeners. He's gazing off somewhere to one side. Artless as his reveries are, he speaks with such sincerity and such heartfelt earnestness that it is hard not to believe what he says. The little mouth of the Virgin is twisted by a smile, and his whole face, his eyes, and his nose are numbed and paralyzed by the foretaste of far-off happiness. The soldiers listen and regard him earnestly, not without compassion. They also believe what he says. I'm not afraid of Siberia, the tramp murmurs on. Siberia and Russia are the same thing. They have the same God there as here, and the same Tsar, and they speak the language of Orthodox Christian. As I am speaking with you, only there is a greater plenty, and the people are richer. Everything is better. Take, for example, the river. They're 1,000 times finer than ours. And fish. Fishing in them is simply beyond words. Fishing, brothers, is the greatest joy of my life. I don't ask for bread, only let me sit and hold a fishing line. Indeed, that is true. I catch fish on a hook and line and in pots and with bow nets. And when the ice comes, I use cast nets. I'm not strong enough to fish with a cast net myself, so I have to hire a peasant for 5 kopecks to do that for me. What fun it is. It's like seeing your own brother again, to catch an eel or a mudfish. And you have to treat every fish differently. I can tell you. You use a minnow for one, and a worm for another, and frog or a grasshopper for a third. You've got to know all that. Take, for example, the eel. The eel isn't a dainty fish. It will take even a newt. Pikes, like earthworms, carfish, butterflies. There is no greater joy on earth than fishing for chubs in a swift water. You bait your hook with a butterfly or a beetle so that it will float on the surface, and you let your line run out some 20 or 30 yards without a sinker. Then you stand in the water without your trousers and let the bait flow down with a current tilt, tug, and there's a chub on the hook. Then you have to watch ever so closely for just the right moment to hook it, or the confounded thing will go off with your bait. The moment it twitches the lines, you've got to pull. There isn't a second to lose. The number of fish I have caught in my life is a caution. When we were escaping, and the other convicts were asleep in the forest, I couldn't sleep, and I would go off in search of a river. The rivers there are so wide and swift and steep bank. It's a caution. And all along their shores lies dense forests. The trees are so high that it makes your head swim to look up to the top of them. According to prices here, every one of those pine trees is worth 10 rubles.
I mean, aren't we suddenly in Hemingway fishing territory? We're in northern Michigan. Young Hemingway is the master of the line.
But that's also, in a way, the Godot, because fishing is about waiting.
Yeah.
You know, fishing is about having the patience to wait and wait and wait and sometimes not get anything and come back the next day and fish again. And
a bad day fishing is better than a good day doing anything else, right?
Yes, that's right. It's still that dilemma of waiting and waiting and knowing what you're going to pull up. But the exciting thing he says is you don't know what you're going to pull up. Yeah. It might be an eel, it might be a chub, it might be a pike, it might be anything.
But he knows who likes what bait. I mean, this is a very accomplished, convincing, persuasive fisherman.
And it's like seeing your own brother again to catch an eel.
Yes!
Oh. There was also this, you know, from the religious context, the idea that he who believes is patient. And I think he found that patience in his religion. I mean, he says that he's a very devout Christian and, you know, he knows the Bible very well. So I think this notion of patience is brought forth.
Mm. The night of faith. Kierkegaard's night of faith. Yeah. You give up all hope, but you wait anyway.
Exactly.
So do we know where we're going? Any guess?
Well, are we wondering if he's going to identify himself?
I don't think he will. Mm. No.
Can they force him?
Do they want to?
It's not like they care too much.
They like him, though, right?
And they believe liking him more and more, I think.
Yeah.
And he's earnest, they're earnest. Everybody's sort of holding their breath here. Let me continue, and then I'll pass it to Ken. Under the confused stress of his imagination, the dream pictures of the past and the sweet foretaste of happiness, the piteous little man stops speaking and only moves his lips as if whispering to himself. The feeble, beatific smile does not leave his face. The soldiers say nothing. Their heads have sunk forward onto their breasts, and they are lost in meditation. In the autumn silence, when a chill, harsh fog from the earth settles on the soul and rises like a prison wall before one to testify to the narrow limits of ah, then it is sweet to dream of wide, swift rivers with bold, fertile banks, of dense forests, of boundless plains. Idly, peacefully, the fancy pictures to itself a man, a tiny speck, appearing on the steep, uninhabited bank of a river in the early morning before the flush of dawn has faded from the sky. The summits of the everlasting pines rise piled high in terraces on either side of the stream, and muttering darkly, look sternly at that free man. Roots, great rocks, and thorny bushes obstruct his path, but he is strong of body and valiant of heart, and fears neither the pines nor the rocks, nor the solitude, nor the rolling echoes that reiterate every footfall. Ken.
The imagination of the soldiers is painting for them pictures of a free life, which they have never lived. Is it that they darkly recall images of things heard long ago? Or have these visions of a life of liberty come down to them with their flesh and blood as an inheritance from their remote, wild ancestors? God only knows. The first to break the silence is Nicander, who until now has not let fall a word. Perhaps he's jealous of the vagrant's visionary happiness. Perhaps he feels in his heart that dreams of bliss are incongruous amidst surroundings of gray mist and brown-black mud. At any rate, he looks sternly at the tramp and says, "That is all very well, brother. That is all very fine. But you'll never reach that land of plenty. How could you? You could go 30 miles and then give up the ghost, a little half-dead creature like you. You've only walked 4 miles today, and yet look at you. You can't seem to get rested at all." The tramp turns slowly to Nicander, and the blissful smile fades from his face. He looks with dismay at the grave countenance of the soldier, as if he had been caught doing wrong, and seems to have recollected something, for he nods his head. Silence falls once more. All three are busy with their own thoughts. The soldiers are trying to force their minds to grasp what perhaps God alone can conceive of the terrible expanse that lies between them and that land of freedom. Images more clear, precise, and terrifying are crowding into the vagrant's head. Courts of justice,
dungeons for exiles and for convicts, prison barracks, weary halts along the road, the cold of winter, illness, the death of his companions, all rise vividly before him. The tramp blinks, and little drops stand out upon his brow. He wipes his forehead with his sleeve, draws a deep breath as if he had just jumped out of a hot oven, wipes his forehead with the other sleeve, and glances fearfully behind him. "It is quite true that you could never get there," Taka assents. "You're not a walker. Look at yourself, all skin and bone. It would kill you, brother." "Of course it would kill him. He couldn't possibly do it," declares Nicander. "He'll be sent straight to the hospital anyway, as it is. That's a fact." The nameless wanderer looks with terror at the stern, impassive faces of his evil-boding fellow travelers. Then, lowering his eyes, he rapidly crosses himself without taking off his cap. He is trembling all over.
Reve will embark on its 12th loop around the sun on Saturday 3rd of May at 5 a.m. UTC plus 1 and will complete its journey on Sunday the 4th of May at 6 a.m. Reve is a collaborative sound and radio project that circles the Earth on live audio streams at daybreak. Reve will be mixed live from a hub at Stave Hill Ecological Park in Rotherhithe, South London, and stations in Sunshine Coast, Australia, Valparaiso, Chile, Chania, Greece. The Reve main mix will be hosted by Wavefarm in Accra, Upper Hudson Valley, New York, and a network of participating FM and net radio stations. For more info and to listen, visit soundtent.org/Reve.
His head is shaking, and he is beginning to writhe like a caterpillar that someone has stepped on. "Come on! Time to go!" cries Nicandrus, rising. "We've rested long enough." Another minute, and the travelers are plodding along the muddy road. The tramp is stooping more than before, and has thrust his hand still deeper into the sleeves of his coat. Taka is silent. 1886.
What is that about? His imagination of freedom, which totally takes over the the minds of those soldiers.
And the story, yeah.
It's funny because we were asking about inspirations that other authors maybe have found in Chekhov. I'm not sure, like, if these things that I see are just parallels or whether they're inspirations. I'd have to find out. But Kurosawa has a film called Dreams. And it's like little short stories. There's one that's very compelling and almost apocalypse-like and very despairing, some of them are at times, and then they find their way out of it. And there's another one where a man walks into a Vincent van Gogh painting and finds Van Gogh in a field painting, and it's Martin Scorsese playing Van Gogh. But it's very similar in this... this reaching, this longing that we have in dreams. And it wasn't until the final few paragraphs that I went back to the title of the short story, which is Dreams. Suddenly I was like, oh,
yeah,
it's all like a dream.
There's one moment, if I'm not mistaken, where it's the landscape that is sort of conjuring up the man. It's the banks, the freedom of the river, the wildness of, I guess, Siberia, that is sort of inventing this whole story. Now, you had that wonderful exposition of his fantasy, like seeing his brother again. Can I just say parenthetically, one of the beauties of reading this stuff aloud is that your eye would pass right over almost all of the value here if you were reading it in a library or in a chair, I think, silently. I don't know. How does that vagrant, that victim, that poor, pathetic no-name take over the minds of those other men?
At first, I felt like they finally got to him. They just told him, "Listen, you're dreaming, you're delusional, your life sucks, that nothing that you're saying is ever going to happen. Just give up. pretty much almost like maybe their own subconscious, like we've given up.
You can't even walk.
Yeah, like 4 miles. Just forget
about themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, but then you mentioned that he has this. He writhes towards the end. He almost feels like he shakes it off, that nothing can really, and he's going to just continue to stumble along, regardless of how bad it is. You know.
But it's such a sustaining thing, and I think probably for most of us, in some ways, this is how much of your brain is occupied by either an imagined future or an imagined past in some ways, because we don't necessarily believe that this guy is the greatest fisherman. You know, there were fish leaping out of the river every time he... But, you know, it has nothing to do with the present or even with the real possibility or reality, yeah. but just that it's so gripping.
Yeah.
You know, this image of this homestead in eastern Siberia or this forest and this river and this, you know, remembered but enhanced kind of abundance and beauty.
What's the Siberian version of all this? Do you know?
You know, it's interesting because when I hear this story, of course I have like the whole chain of association in my head, I don't know, from childhood, from my life there. When I hear you guys talk, it's a completely different chain of association, you know? So it's very interesting to compare. I don't know what actually to say. I think the image of bright future was very big for Russia anyway, because the presence is always gloomy, or you look at it as a very gloomy thing. And I was just actually thinking that, you know, Rachmaninoff, who lived at the same time, he had two romances which called Dreams. And actually, if you listen to Russian music, there's like this dreamy element. It's like not about present, it's about imaginary world. So
yeah, I love Sarah's point about he's this momentary midpoint between an imagined past or a completely uncertain past, you name it. Where did he come from? And this uncertain future, complete mystery, and he's fabricating it all. Dina, though, you raise an interesting point. I keep wondering, what is the music of these stories? Rachmaninoff was almost a contemporary, Tchaikovsky very much a contemporary, and a friend.
And they were friends. Yeah.
And lots of others. What is the musical sound? What is the theme music under this roaring stream?
Actually, the music of this period is so unbelievably beautiful. You know, so I think it has this element of just unattainable beauty, you know, and dreamy world. But I don't think they can think they have achieved it, you know. I think this kind of hopeless quality, at least it's what I think about. You know.
But just forgive me for being too literal, but is it a hopeless ending? The vagrant is stooping lower and his hands deeper into his pockets at the end, and they're bombarding him with his terrible situation. He's sickly, he can't make it, he'd never get to Siberia in the first place. But is he defeated or not? I wonder.
Oh, no, they haven't destroyed his imagination, his alternative world that he must have.
Spell it out.
That's why the ending seems so totally modern. You talk about who's influenced by this. James Joyce. Right. You think, well, did he invent the modern short story? Hell no. He read Chekhov wrote The Dubliners. But this end that you think it isn't an end, but it is an end because the imagination is endless in that story. I don't think he's defeated at the end. I don't think the soldiers want to defeat him. First, I thought they're going to beat hell out of him.
What about the fact that Chekhov takes over the ending? Right? Mm-hmm. It's no longer the tramp talking about, it becomes this sort of authorial voice that comes in,
mm-hmm.
right? And mm-hmm. I'm always wondering, like, you know, who is Chekhov allied with? You know, for a long time he has me thinking, oh, Chekhov is with the tramp here, right? But then he just actually disavows it. It seems to me like he takes over the story and gives us this landscape, and which makes me curious about the Siberian landscape, right? Is it the kind of landscape that inspires kind of like this non-committal flirtation with the supernatural sort of, right? I'm just wondering, like, what is Chekhov, like, trying to sort of think about in this space because he is having this dalliance with the cloth of religion, right? He's playing with it. It seems to me mocking it. And almost in a godlike fashion, he takes over the end of the story, right? He comes in and sort of gives you the great wrap-up.
What feels by coming in at the end, he's showing that the vagrant has shut off. These guys are beyond hope. If all they can see is my wasted body, then what's the point of talking to them? What's the point of telling them how beautiful it is in my mind if they can't connect? I don't know. It feels like he, by taking over at the end, Chekhov has said, like, well, he's turned these guys off. He's gone back. He's just walking.
So many Chekhov stories end formally unresolved, and we'll read these love stories. There are lots of them, actually, in which it basically becomes a question of should I leave or should I stay, and is this a hopeless relationship or not? But it seems to me in this case, which is quite unresolved, I love your line, Luke, that this, of course, the imagination is the driving character here, and of course the imagination prevails. He can't be defeated.
Or is the title ironic? Dreams.
Dreams. It sounds to me like that incredibly all-encompassing Dostoevsky story called The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, who dreams that he is captured by aliens, taken to another planet, shown a beautiful way to live, and he comes back to preach the gospel, basically. Treat people as you would be treated. And people stop him on the street and say, you're just dreaming. You just had a dream. And he says, your reality made me want to kill myself. It was my dream that made me want to live. So the dream wins. Of course the dream has to win.
I mean, he's not desperately curious to know a kind of truth about it. You know, he's got this, you know, I don't know whether I could be a peasant. I could be a of noble birth. My mother, she might have murdered him. She might not. I'm not really sure. You know, he's not trying to find, like, a hard truth of his life or his...
Interesting.
You know, his mother.
He is a man who's defined by his hopes and not his fears. No, I'm just actually quoting Obama on Mandela's funeral. But I lived through a war, and
which war?
The Yugoslav war of the late '90s, and even then, one thing that we had our situation, all we had was our hopes and dreams, you know. And if we had given up on that, then it meant that we're dead. We might as well just be dead. Viktor Frankl has an incredible book called Man's Search for Meaning, where he creates a world that he lived through the Holocaust. He was sent to concentration camps, and the first signs that people were demonstrating when they were would be, you know, they would start smoking, and subsequently they would either run to grab the electrical fence or they would just try to escape and the Nazis would shoot them. So then he creates this notion of, regardless to how bad your current times are, and how awful it may seem, there's still hope for the future, you know. And I think that's the theme here, that, you know, Chekhov's trying to say that, you know. In Miria, it's cold, and don't worry about these other two guys. You live in your world and keep hope and keep living, keep dreaming, because that's the only thing that you have. And well, that's the choice that only you can make, I guess.
No, and a fear, essentially the fears we all live with, that he's living with, these scenarios the soldiers are painting, are really only other imaginations. They're really, really only darker,
yeah,
or darker dreams of something that may or may not happen. Mm-hmm. And yet you think of all the things that, you know, crack your head, all the...
Last call. What do we learn about Chekhov himself here? Other than that it was nonsense that he wrote these stories quickly, batted them off in a day, or that they were innocent or somehow naive little narratives.
There's a kind of ruthlessness that actually I like. It's like the ruthlessness of nature. It doesn't play favorites. You know, it rains on everybody. It snows on everybody. It's cold on everybody. And then I think of this landscape. It doesn't matter when you're in that landscape if you're noble or not, unless you happen to have a fur coat as opposed to nothing.
But interesting.
There's a kind of ruthlessness to these stories that I appreciate when I hear it. I think it's accurate.
Great art's always ruthless, right?
Yeah.
Think about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, Ken, Sarah, Yazi, thank you. And thank you, Anton Chekhov. For Dreams, we've been reading from the Norton edition of Chekhov Stories. Marion Fell did our translation of Dreams. Blutanya Hande, Ebbes Hande, Blutanya Hande. Thanks to Yo-Yo Ma for his version of the Rococo Variations composed by Chekhov's friend Tchaikovsky. Special thanks to the audio pro on so many stages, Jim Donahue, who wired us all for sound. Listeners out there, we'll be delighted to hear your take on this story and on our impressions of it. Next up, if you care to read ahead, will be Gusev, the Chekhov tale of a soldier heading home on shipboard from war in the East. Mary McGrath is producer and editor of this podcast series. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Reading Chekhov project, and do pass it on.
Ich rede mit mir selbst. Ich bin mein Radio.